avoiding emotions, especially the harder ones like anger, or even, you know, like we talked about unforgiveness last time, shame and guilt. If we start avoiding them, that can be very stressful biologically, and they come out like a volcanic eruption. You're tuned into episode 4 of Mind the Gap, a podcast where we bridge diverse perspectives one conversation at a time.
Welcome to Mind the Gap, a podcast where every fortnight we explore the topics of self-leadership and neuroscience in service of holistic well-being.
I'm Harmeet Anand, with extensive experience coaching leaders across global organizations. I use the ontological approach, somatic principles, and mindfulness practices to support the leaders and teams I coach.
And I'm Sana Anand, with a background in heart science and a budding neuroscientist. We'd like to preface that we are not experts in these realms,
and we invite you to join us in our podcast, where we document our conversations, offering distinct generational and professional points of view. Stay tuned.
So far we have tried to bring in our experiences as well as our knowledge around different aspects of life, like purpose, intention, practices. And today we are here to talk about stress, a very relevant topic, especially in today's time.
Yeah, and often has many, many misconceptions to go with it as well.
I think for me, I have always thought that stress is good for me. Like when I'm trying to chase some deadlines, I tend to do them with more enthusiasm, motivation, and, you know, determination. I think stress is both good and bad.
Definitely something for us to get into later. But there's a difference between the two kinds of stress that you're talking about. Maybe you tend to experience one more than the other, but they both do exist. But before we get into that, I'd like to define stress.
That would be great, yeah.
Biologically and psychologically. Biologically, I guess stress is when there's a disruption to our equilibrium, balance, the sense of homeostasis. But psychologically, it could be a sense of loss, a perceived sense of loss, where you think you're going to lose something, so you hold on even more tightly to this. And this could be a person, a job, or a relationship, anything of that sort.
And on the topic of loss, in our day-to-day life, I think there's also this feeling of loss of control. Today only when I was coming here and the car kind of whizzed past from the wrong side, I was pretty stressed and frustrated with whatever happened. So most of the time, it's also not a physical loss, but actually a loss feeling of something. You know, when people come to me, they have this question about life is very stressful. How do you manage it? How should we manage it? But I want to go first and, you know, a level deeper just to understand what is it that we should be managing? What's happening biologically inside us?
Yeah, when people come and they ask you this question of like, how do we manage it? It's a difficult question to answer because what we perceive as a stressor can be very different from person to person, but the mechanisms at play are largely similar across all people. And that is, there are two systems. The sympathetic nervous system, which is the fight or flight, and I know you've heard of that definitely. It's when the adrenaline is released in this instant moment. It's a fast acting system. And you're able to mobilize metabolic processes so that our muscles can move better and we're able to target the physical barrier or the physical obstacle in front of us that's causing us stress. And the slower, more hormonal process at play is the HPA axis. So the hypothalamus gets activated, which activates the pituitary gland, and that consequently activates the adrenal gland, which sits on top of our kidneys, which secretes cortisol. That cortisol can go back to downregulate the entire HPA axis and binds to those receptors, as well as has implications on other systems like the reproductive system or the immunological system. And this is in a healthy functioning person where this negative feedback actually works, but there are cases where that negative feedback is not as functioning.
So for our listeners, let's just distinguish between what is acute stress and chronic stress. Acute seems
so
to
what
be what
you're defining
first.
Yeah, as good or bad stress, and that instant of like having a deadline, it actually pushes you or motivates you to do better. After the deadline's over, that stressor is practically gone.
that would be considered more acute stress, which we do need in our day-to-day lives.
So. Or even when we have to file our taxes. Like, yeah. It's for a week that people are usually very stressed.
We need that stress to maintain our metabolic processes, our blood pressure. Actually, it helps our immunological functioning and is very, very important in increasing our energy and lowering our fatigue. But when that stress becomes chronic, then it can have extreme impacts on autoimmune disorders as well as hippocampal excitotoxicity. So it can lead to the degradation of our neurons in our hippocampus as well as our prefrontal cortex, and causes metabolic dysregulation as well. So everything that I was saying in acute stress, any of the good benefits of cortisol become completely negative effects in chronic stress.
Yeah, and I think for most of us, you know, we are able to manage these day-to-day events of acute stress. But there are times when we are part of cultures or even families which can be toxic, or having, let's say, a toxic boss or toxic culture at work, which is when stress tends to remain chronically experienced in our bodies. And that's when it can lead to breakdowns, which are health breakdowns.
Yeah, and whether that's conscious or not. Establishing that is really meaningful, though, the difference between acute and chronic stress, because we're used to demonizing cortisol in the media. That really got to me at some point, and I tried to maintain a very constant state where I'd avoid certain situations that excited me too much or caused me to have like an extreme emotion. And I was indifferent to life events, whether they were both positive or negative, because I was scared they'd have some sort of impact on my stress levels and raise my cortisol levels. But that numbing of emotions also plays a role in causing stress.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, numbing emotions actually was not a language that I had when I was at your age.
Mm-hmm.
But I know what you're saying, because I always got this feedback from my friends that I have a very calm presence. I think so do you at this point in time. But
yeah.
It was an experience that only I understood, because I was like a duck on calm waters. Like, on top, you feel it's sailing very smoothly,
really,
but I didn't like badly. Yeah. So I think part of that was my behavior also in terms of avoiding situations which would cause more stress to me. And today I am very aware. It's amazing that you are aware of it already right now.
It makes sense too, biologically, because when people view emotionally salient stimuli, it activates their limbic system. But then when they try to actively suppress that, their prefrontal cortex actually tries to suppress the limbic system and exert that cognitive control, and that ends up causing stress on our system, so we end up having a sympathetic nervous system response. Yeah,
you know, experience in coaching people, especially in corporates, there people think that it is inappropriate to express your emotions, and because of that they also demonize emotions per se. It's like not good to have emotions. Avoiding emotions, especially the harder ones, like anger, or even, you know, like we talked about unforgiveness last time, shame and guilt. If we start avoiding them, that can be very stressful biologically. And they come out like a volcanic eruption.
Yeah, I think there's a scale for every emotion where there's like a positive degree to which any emotion can be felt and a negative degree to which any emotion can be felt. Like, there is no inherent quality of good or bad to any affect, despite the notion of there being negative or positive affects. We've talked about stress being real and it also being perceived, and this aspect of centering actually helps determine reality. But how do we actually center?
There's so many ways of centering. In our brain, we center by silence. In our body, we center by stillness. And in our emotions, we can center by accepting whatever's happening in the moment. Most importantly is having a habit of centering, because when stress arises, it's really hard to center at that point in time. Unless we have a habit of centering, it's hard to call that into action.
Yeah, and that balance is such a crucial element to distinguishing that real versus perceived kind of stress. You know, for me, an imbalance of at least my feet, like I'm flat-footed and I've also had scoliosis, so my back was curved. So in that area, I thought that I had like a fear of falling thing. I'm trying to protect myself from something. In a sense, there's also preemption of loss. And because I've identified that, I know how to pull myself out of leaning into that curvature. And then when I do that, it makes me feel like I actually have the resources to counter that obstacle that I'm experiencing and face it as a challenge rather than a threat to my being. So when you experience a stressor, there is a automatic response where you feel you are off center. Yeah, and I'll be leaning a particular way, almost trying to guard myself from something. And it actually stops, it stresses me out more and stops me from countering that head on. And then how do you find your center back again? Adjusting the body, because I do think that we find it annoying when people tell us, like, you're stressed out, just like calm down and try to use the mind to calm the mind. But in these times, the first order of response is not using the mind to calm the mind, but using the body to address the mind so that the mind can then address the mind.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, you can't change your consciousness operating from the same level of consciousness. And to your question, how do people center? For me, when I teach people centering, it's a three-dimensional practice, which actually includes what you mentioned, aligning your spine, lengthening it, expanding it, as well as occupying the entire fullness of who we are. It's a very crucial aspect of centering.
And that occupying entire fullness of who we are you talking about breathing as well, in a sense?
Breathing is one of the most simplest things that we can actually do to center ourselves. But as I say, the simple things are not actually easy to do. It becomes really hard.
You forget about it in the moment, actually. But if you build it to being automatic, as you said, practice it so that when you actually need to use it, you can mobilize it, then it gets important. This idea of breathing is a point of contention for me because the Western area of research are just putting all of their attention on that now and are like renaming certain breathing techniques that we have in yoga with their own terminology, like a physiological sigh. But we know that as like Kapalbhati or other sort of pranayamas in yoga exercises or in Brahma Vidya, which is another breathing exercise. What happens here physiologically, though, is that we have longer exhales than we do inhales. And that it happens when we exhale, our diaphragm goes up. So then our heart volume decreases and so our blood moves faster. So the brain signals to the body to circulate that blood slower. And so it decreases the heart rate, which ends up balancing the sympathetic nervous system, the fight or flight system, with the parasympathetic nervous system, which is the rest and digest. And that's such an interesting way to think about how an evolutionary process like crying and sobbing, which also uses this idea of longer exhales and inhales, as well as taking a longer exhales and inhales before we sleep, is actually something that's been built into us. It's just something we need to harness when we need it.
But what happens when we are chronically stressed? This is, you know, our physical response to acute stress. Doesn't it get harder for our biological systems when all our circumstances and our environment is forever stressful?
Yeah, and it gets damaging in the long run too, on both our body and our brain. And actually, it's been seen that elderly women that have to take care of their spouses that are dealing with dementia experience greater oxidative stress, which is a form of quantifying biological aging, where free radicals damage the cells of the body. In comparison to people that actually experienced acute stress and were able to maintain some sort of psychobiological resilience towards their stress. And I find this quite sad and ironic, actually, that they're experiencing this oxidative stress, because it's also one of the causes of Alzheimer's and dementia too. So these women that are taking care of their spouses with that very disease could maybe someday get it.
You know, resilience is a term that we use very often. And although it's believed that resilience is about coming out from a very stressful event, bouncing right back in the area of somatics and well-being, it's a way of being and feeling more connected to the world outside you.
Mm-hmm.
Like just feeling that you are still interconnected as humanity or with nature. And I find that having a resilience practice, for me, running is a resilience practice, and a specific kind of running. Like it has to be outdoors. It has to be when I can feel some water on my skin and the sweat on my skin, is a great way to reconnect when I'm stressful. Yeah. What about you?
I have exercise as my resilience practice as well. And it's not just us thinking that it is a resilience practice, but exercise biologically too, into decreasing the effects that stress has. So we have a lot of dendritic spines in our neurons in the hippocampus that get damaged through toxic effects of cortisol when it's chronically released. It's hypothesized that that's because it's adaptive to numb out these adverse memories associated with stress. But it's been found that exercise helps moderate nerve growth factors that can actually help moderate the effect on the dendritic spines.
Okay, so I'm thinking of a woman, like, as a post-op premenopausal woman.
Yeah.
There's a declining estrogen that's happening. And there is, I've heard that estrogen plays an oxidative or antioxidative role, you know, in terms of what it does to our body and organisms. And
yeah, and speaking of this biological forms of resilience, you also spoke about exercise as a sort of psychological form of resilience. Estrogen actually plays a role in increasing our nerve factors and can contribute to dendritic spine density. So it's very important in postmenopausal women as well to help balance their levels of stress and counteract whatever the decline they're already facing.
So I've found that with aging, generally for public, it might be yoga and meditation and more calming, you know, way of being with their bodies and, you know, their life that might operate. But in my case, it's completely different. I feel movement is actually adding better health outcomes for me, or even meeting more people is actually, you know, increasing the sense of network that I have, the connection that I have, and keeping me more grounded and happy.
You know, the types of stress also change with the different life stages that we are at, and therefore the management methods also have to change adaptively with that as we grow. So just to summarize, stress is, as I was saying, not all bad. It's a natural response, but avoiding it is what we wish we could do, but we can't necessarily do all the time, unfortunately.
And what we should not do when we are experiencing stress, realize that it is it's an unhealthy coping mechanism following some addictive behaviors like watching too much of TV, Netflix all the time, or even, you know, binge eating. Those things really don't work because they just add more stress to our body in the long
run. And it's like we're trying to compensate for that perceived loss, as if that food is going to be taken from us at some point, or the entertainment is going to be taken from us. All of that, we're trying to compensate for some sort of loss. But just understanding that we don't need to binge to bury our emotions is a big part of addressing stress. You know?
And I think a very important point that we spoke about today is this whole stress that gets added when we are trying to avoid feeling stressful or avoid feeling those strong emotions. Just facing the emotions and reflecting what is it that we really care about that is leading us to feel that way, especially if they are a very high stressful emotions like anger, frustration, shame, guilt, etc.
Thank you for this lovely conversation.
Thank you so much for your inputs, and I loved connecting with you today as well, like always.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Mind the Gap. You can subscribe to the show wherever you're listening to this. We hope you learned something from our different perspectives, and if you did, let us know your takeaways on our social media Instagram handle at mindthegap.show.
You can access the show notes of this episode on coachformax.com. That's coach4max.com. Thank you so much for listening, and we hope you feel motivated to engage in conversations that bridge diverse perspectives and create greater mutual understanding.